Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour. We are Christmas edition, Christmas with Dragons Under the Tree, with Jason Diamond and Matt Wallen. How are you guys? Happy Christmas.
Good.
Welcome to the end of the year. Another year gone, another set of visual effects films that have made money for everyone in the world but the visual effects artists. No, I want to be negative, I want to be positive. This week on the show, we're discussing The Hobbit, which is The Desolation of Smaug, which I think is a spectacularly good film. Liked it a lot, the second in the series. We're not going to discuss 48 frames particular. We're not going to go down that particular rat hole. We're going to discuss the visual effects, as we always do. But before we do that, we're going to discuss how much Matt Wallen enjoyed the film, because Matt just, I think this is your favorite film of the year, isn't it, Matt?
Well, okay, so I saw this movie as the director himself intended in IMAX 3D, high frame rate. And I would just say, I would just start off by saying, I think Peter Jackson is to filmmaking what Thomas Kinkade is to painting.
Well, that's deep.
I hated this movie. I thought it was terrible. It was almost unwatchable. Like, the movie could have been, for my money, it could have been in Chinese, and I would have gotten as much out of it as I got out of the movie that I saw. I really thought it was just terrible. I was an embarrassingly bad movie.
Okay, well, not for those of you that don't know, Thomas Kinkade, if you've just been trying to Google him, tends to produce what I'm going to call cigar box type art. Colourful, very uninspired, very Christmas card, birthday card looking kind of paintings. So we have one in favour of this featuring not only a great story, but I would say probably one of the greatest pieces of CG creature animation mankind has ever yet done, and one guy who thinks it's on par with a Hallmark card. So that means the jury is going to be swayed by whatever you have to say, Mr. Diamond.
When you said Thomas Kinkade, I thought of Mr. Kinkade from the Partridge Family.
That would be a good place to go.
And That's Reuben Kinkade.
That's Reuben Kinkade.
Come on.
Exactly.
What a great comb-over.
That would make Bilbo Danny Partridge, no?
Okay.
Anyway.
Stop now.
I did actually enjoy the film. Mind-blowingly incredible, but it was way better than the first one. First one I thought was fairly boring, as I solidified by watching it again, somehow. And I thought this one had a lot more action. I went with my kid, my 7-year-old kid, who loved it. And I do also agree that Smaug is fucking incredible. I loved Smaug from
monumental
frame one. And I'm also a huge fan of Don Bluth's Dragon Lair video game, Dragon's Lair, mm-hmm. which I played as a kid.
Yep.
So, dragons in lots of coins, I already have an affinity for, but it was, I would say the coin, we'll get into this, but I would say the coin sim, all that stuff they developed for that is on par with the snow from Frozen. It's just like, I was really impressed. And I don't see, I have not seen a lot of Benedict Cumberbatch's work, but I would not hesitate to say that this was his best acting. Is the voice of Smaug.
Okay, so let's find out why our, I would say normally highly educated, but clearly today delusional, co-host, Mr. Matt Wallen, is so completely off base. Matt, what is it that you didn't like about this film? Before we get to the visual effects, just what is it you didn't like? It had fun, it had ears, it had swords, it had water, it had dragons. Just like, isn't this everything you want from a cinema experience?
If that's all a movie needs to be good, then I guess it's a great movie. But I mean, I saw it, you know, at a really great theater with great projection and great sound, and in the way in which I think it was intended to be seen by the filmmaker. And I thought it was just incredibly boring. Like, there was very little, you know, character development, very little plot. There was like, you know, it was so confusing. Like it required, as a movie itself, I think it was very difficult to ascertain and follow what was going on. And people would say, you know, I think in defense of that, people would say, well, have you read the book? And it's like, well, no, I saw the movie, right? Like, I didn't know there was homework before I went to see the movie, right? Like, I went and saw the movie, and I mean, I saw the first one on a screener, and I fell asleep. It was really boring. I didn't really enjoy it. I didn't like the way in which the story was told. I didn't like the world. I didn't like so many of the conceits of that. The attempt at humor I thought was really ham-fisted, and I don't know. I just thought this movie was such a total mess. I couldn't imagine sitting in the screening room as the filmmakers and watching this movie and saying, like, yeah, this is good. This is good. This is what we're going to put out. Like, I thought it was a disaster. I mean, I think it was one of the worst movies I've seen, you know, in the... I mean,
I just can't begin to tell you how much... I just can't get this. It's like you saw a completely different film. It's like everybody I saw the film with enjoyed it. My wife enjoyed it. It was funny. There were funny things in it.
Really?
There was
what
dramatic
was funny
things
in it, though? There was nothing funny.
Going down the barrel thing, and then the barrel flips out and wipes out about 18
hooks. When they're in the barrels and they're going down the shaving cream river? What? Like, what was that?
And the dragon was well done. It wasn't just a big scary oaf. It was like
huge sequence at the end that was all in black and white. Right, where they completely desaturated everything in the gray.
You are just completely.
I mean, it was. I thought it was one of the worst movies I've seen.
Well, to be fair,
it cost that much money in a long time. It was terrible.
To be fair, if you were going to get in the color correction in the dragon's lair with all that gold and silver, there wouldn't be much color reflected from the ambient light. It would be all sort of monochromatic. No.
Well, yeah, but let's. You know, I mean, there are a lot of things to like about the end sequence, and I think like the lack of, you know, Technicolor dream coats and sparkling kind of, you know, highlights that were. I mean, how could you even be focused on that with such great character animation? Okay, well, let's work our way through the visual effects. Clearly, didn't like the
but
plot.
Such poor character. Illumination, character development.
What are you talking about? It was an interesting character.
Who? Oh, the dragon?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, he was the only interesting character in the movie.
Oh, sod off. All right.
What happened? What was that whole part where, like, all the little midgets, like, they show up at the door of the thing, and then they're, like, the sun sets, and they're all just like, ah, screw it, let's go home.
Yeah, that was...
Like, what?
That was... I definitely remember being like, what? Wow, they gave up really easily.
Yeah, total quitters. Like, I was just like, what? I don't know. After all they went through to get there, and then they just like...
You didn't think that Lake Town was amusing and interesting and beautifully rendered?
Lake Town looked to me like, again, it had some of that Thomas Kinkade vibe, but it also looked a lot like Robert Altman's Popeye. That's what I kept thinking when I saw that. I was just like, wow, that looks just exactly like Robert Altman's Popeye. And boy, that was a huge successful film.
I actually thought it looked more like Total Recall in the water. The new Total Recall.
In the water? What, I don't follow you.
Well, because that one was sort of up, right, in these weird cubes.
Yeah.
But this one was on a lake. But it had the same vibe.
It had like a it had Dickens style London-esque
Dicksonian
kind of feel to it. It was terrific.
Oh no, I was just gonna say, so with regards to you said we can't really go into the high frame rate. You didn't want to talk about it, but
I just don't want to get bogged down on it because we had a lengthy discussion about it on the first film, and I just feel like there's minor differences
between. But I feel like it's such a huge part of what is. It's a huge part of one of the things that I think is so fundamentally wrong with this movie, though. If you see it in that form, which is, I think, the form that it's intended to be seen in, like, I mean, there are so many problems, I think, with, like, even effects sequences and composites and stuff. They're almost disastrous, I think, in the way that they come across. Like, it doesn't work. Like, it looks really bad. I can't imagine looking at some of the shots that I saw in this movie and composites and stuff in some of the key sequences and saying that those were good. I don't know. I was shocked.
I refuse to see this movie in high frame rate because I saw the first one high frame rate 3D and I wanted to just blow my brains out. So when I went with my kid, I saw 3D, But I specifically went to the 24-frame 3D, and I was much more pleased with the look of the film.
So I'd never seen a high frame rate.
Movie. Well, that's why.
Except for what they showed, you know, the James Cameron thing at Seagraph.
Yeah, whatever.
Last year or 2 years ago or whatever, where they had all those guys get up and they were kind of selling, you know, and he made this really like goofy, again, another weird like Renaissance kind of.
Oh, hang
dinner,
on, that was a test
dinner
footage.
Theater. That's thing. Just the, well, that's, I know, but I mean, but it looks the film. Same. It looks exactly the same. It's the same as like all the stuff in this movie. It's the same kind of like weird where everything's in focus and everything is lit so brightly too. Like there's very little subtlety in the lighting, and I don't know.
It was more subtle in the 24 frame. Like it looks like more like a normal film. It looks more subdued. I don't know if because you're getting half as much information. I don't know, but. Certainly.
I have no idea. I don't know. I don't get it. I don't know. It was like, I just don't understand like the point of so much of that kind of pursuit. Like it really, I love movies. Don't get me wrong. Like I love movies. Like it's everything to me to go to the movies. It's my favorite thing to do. Like, and I'm willing to go and experience a movie like this and to kind of go as open-minded as I can, you know, with, I do have some biases, I think, to the genre, but that being said, like, you know, I'll go as open-minded as I can to see it. And I went and saw it, and I went and saw it in the way that I thought, well, this is going to be the best way I could possibly see it. And like, it was so, I don't know. I don't get it. I don't know how people are saying they liked it. I've made a couple of snide comments after seeing it, like, but I mean, they were heartfelt snide comments, if there is such a thing. And I got a lot of really actually weirdly positive feedback from people who were like, oh my god, yeah, it was awful. Like, I mean, I had a lot of people who were coming out of the woodwork and like, you know, these closet
hang on, let's
haters.
Let's, yeah, okay, well, possibly, but the other point is The Hobbit Unexpected Journey grossed over $1 billion. This one's grossed $205 million in its opening weekend, generally has really good reviews, certainly has not had bad reviews. And I mean, you know, like I appreciate your point of view, and I'm not for a second saying that it's invalid, but I don't think you should imply that there's an undercurrent of discontent with the film, because that just simply isn't true. I mean, it's 75% or whatever on The Hobbit on Rotten Tomatoes, which is not, you know, like 100%. It's like 90% is what The Hunger Games got, right? But it's not, you know. Man of Steel got 56%, so it's not as if it's at the low end of the spectrum. It's, you know,
well,
higher than Elysium.
Like,
well, I'm just saying, like, it's on, in terms of Rotten Tomatoes score, right, it's on par with, you know, with a sensible set of reviews and expectations and stuff. So there certainly is no massive backlash against this film. I don't want to imply that there is. I totally think your opinion's valid. I want to hear about it. And
I wouldn't say either that. I mean, that's a fair point you're making, Mike. And I don't mean to suggest that like I'm speaking for like some hidden hole of humanity by any stretch of the imagination. Like, you know, I think like probably a lot of the listeners too, though, and like you guys. I mean, I come from, you know, a subset of the culture that, you know, are a lot of my colleagues, a lot of my friends are people who I've worked with in the business, some of whom I've worked with, you know, at Weta, you know. I mean, so I'm just speaking from, you know, my, and it's,
no,
and again, it's,
and,
it's,
and
it's,
I think that's,
it's
completely
anecdotal,
valid.
It's anecdotal, yeah. Information. It's not by any stretch of the imagination. I'm not trying to suggest that it's some,
but
know,
I'm just saying that if you
statement.
Just look at it from a Rotten Tomatoes score point of view or a box office point of view, you know, this film's doing better than Elysium, Pacific Rim, Wolverine, Man of Steel.
Well,
like, you
yeah,
know,
but
this
I mean,
is,
but I mean, that's, but it's, that's one,
well,
measure.
Thor,
and I think
end
that's
of, a, end
it's a
game,
populist,
like,
it's a populist, yeah, measure. I mean, it'd be like saying like McDonald's is a great restaurant because it's like however many billions of people have been.
No, but it's saying that it's finding an audience and that critics aren't panning it is what I'm saying, right? So,
okay.
So it's
okay.
Good to discuss, okay, this, but like we, you know, keep it in check is like it is.
Right, well, I just had to get my, I had to get my, my feelings about this.
And
out,
I just had to bitch slap you down, my friend, because
no,
you know,
it's fair and fair enough. Yeah. I mean,
I love this film, but but more importantly, I think, well, let's move to the visual effects. I think,
okay,
that your opinion is valid, and I, you know, I welcome it, and I don't understand it at all. But it's not the first time you and I have disagreed. You have a completely warped view about superheroes that makes no sense to me whatsoever. complete lack of understanding of the genius of Christopher Nolan. I just don't want to even get touch on. So, you know, but that being said, I respect you enormously for a man who is psychotic, and let's keep going. Okay. So discussing the visual effects, I think we're going to have to go straight to Smaug because we've already discussed him a bit. This is a very complex piece of digital character animation work that is interesting, in my opinion, because it has a couple of things going for it. It's a lot of screen time, so it's not just like a Fright Night kind of jumping out thing. Secondly, the character has to look intelligent and ferocious. It has to be threatening and eloquent. It has to talk and also look like it's not the sort of creature that is anthropomorphized or comical. It has to basically communicate and have a dialogue while still not looking as if it's moved too far away from being, you know, kind of a reptile in DNA. So there's a lot of aspects that make it hard. Like lip syncing or lip manipulation is really difficult on a crocodile type face because the face doesn't go well for doing that kind of stuff. It's not like you've got big jowls. It's not like a dog where you've got moving things that you can kind of bend around a bit to get stuff out. There's a lot of difficulty in getting performance out of it. There's a lot of difficulty in sustaining the performance for the 9 minutes or so it's doing it. And then it's got to act in a way that denotes huge scale. It's twice the size of a jumbo jet, talking to a creature smaller than a man, and holding that scale and framing that so it feels like it's got scale is a difficult problem for the blocking and animation team as much as it is for the character animation team. So there's a lot of aspects of this character that I think are hard. And I think almost without hesitation that this is one of the finest pieces of character animation we've seen in terms of a creature. So that's where I'm coming from. So can we discuss Smaug not in terms of story but in terms of execution, and perhaps Matt, get your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, that I think that's a fair assessment. So not in terms of story, but in terms of execution of the technical feat of bringing the character to life. I think, I think it was one of the few strokes of genius in the filmmaker's planning was to cast Benedict Cumberbatch as the voice of is it Smaug or is it Smaug? Right, they say Smaug in all the advertisements on TV, which also drives me crazy. But
Smaug.
But I think he was a great choice, and I think that the execution of the dragon for the most part was really successful. There's at least, you know, a dozen shots that stick out in my mind, usually ones where he's looking straight at camera and coming really quickly towards camera, that I thought were really incredibly well executed and well lit and really powerful. The animation was really stellar. I think the lip sync, you know, like you're saying, Mike, I think that idea of the that sort of long, I don't know if you'd call it a snout, but the snout of like an alligator or of a dragon in this case, yeah, that is very difficult to achieve and attain a kind of lip sync. I remember I worked on Dragonheart back at ILM in the way back machine, and I remember that was one of the things in the lip sync for the Sean Connery voiceover for the dragon in Dragonheart that was difficult too, is that, but although his anatomical structure was different in that the that kind of snout-like structure was foreshortened, it was much more closer to the face, and I think that what they were able to do with him and sort of the movement through the scenes in that sort of underground lair, I thought were really great. There were a few times, though, at least, and again, this is something that I can't really speak to, having only seen it in the high frame rate version, but there were a few times where I did find that the scale was jumping around a lot. It was difficult for me, in particular, to maintain a sense of scale with some of the... there were some fluid sims when I guess it was the gold that had been activated, and the blobbiness and the size of the blobbiness of the and the smaller particulate matter of the gold, the scale oftentimes was so the blobs were so large in scale that I thought to my eye I felt it betrayed the scale of the dragon, like it made the dragon feel small, and so that was something that you know, overall, I think the character of the dragon was a huge success, but I thought sometimes the integration of the dragon in some of the larger contexts of some of the scenes, the scale felt weird. And I don't know if that was high frame rate or if it was like I was suggesting with some of the fluid sims and stuff where I sort of felt like, I don't know, like that looks like the wrong size or something. Like
I definitely think the most successful Smaug stuff for me is the conversation with Bilbo rather than the forge where he goes down. I think... yeah, well, Jason, what do you think?
I agree. I was captivated, sort of jaw-droppingly, for the conversation that he has with Bilbo. Because, and this sounds like a story point, but I think it's an animation point, is that you have to convey that why the dragon wouldn't just burn him up and go back to sleep. You know what I mean? Like, he's... clearly intrigued, and for that to come across in the animation performance is extremely difficult, I think. And he came across as very intelligent as a dragon. You know, you don't really have a point of reference for how intelligent a dragon would be, per se. But the just the manner in which it sort of moved in its environment and was with confidence, I mean, that is some... I think that speaks to the animation purely. My only issue with the forge, I actually really liked when he got covered in gold. The scale that was weird for me was just the halls were so big. Like, you know, dwarves made these halls that are bigger than a dragon that's the size of two jumbo jets. It's so hard to reconcile the scale of the inside of it's not Moria, right?
You mean, yeah, no, it's
where the Durin's
there. Yeah, it's sorry, I'm blanking, but I do know what you're saying. Like, it's difficult for me to comprehend the dwarves having that much gold as well. It seemed like a large amount of gold.
Well, it's also just so huge that the dragon gets lost. It's sort of... at times, it's sort of like the Pacific Rim issue where you never really got a lot of, you know, for things that massive, you really need scale. And the scale reference in this case is something that you also don't really understand scale of.
Yeah, I mean, I have a fundamental problem with Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit at a construction point of view, which is that there seems to have been a time in Middle Earth where there were huge industrial construction crews that would come in and build loads of stuff. And whenever they built loads of stuff, they built really impressive big loads of stuff, bigger than the pyramids, more impressive than the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, just enormous amounts of stuff. And then no one seems to be building anything anymore. So, like, whether it's a statue on the side of a mountain or these halls, I mean, this is a... It's like I've always felt like the society has produced a level of engineering skill and material manipulation skills that somehow has evaporated from Middle Earth. It's like, how [S2] Right. [S1] The heck did they build all this stuff? Now, is it... somebody might say it's all done with magic, but it doesn't feel that way. It feels like, especially in the forges, that it was meant to be denoting a... but there doesn't seem like anyone that has those skills. Everybody's like a sorcerer or a swordsman or you know, a bowman or a gardener, right, or a, you know, somebody that's in the fields, but nobody seems to be a construction worker. Like, in a society like this...
Gandalf barely uses magic in... I mean, this one he used it a lot more. But in both Lord of the Rings and the first Hobbit movie, he really doesn't use magic. He uses his deduction skills very well of what he needs to do. And then he basically tells whoever he's with, see you later, you're on your own, I got some shit to take care of.
Yeah, well, okay, but that is plot again. And
I was
the one that said that we should move away.
That
from
is plot. Plot.
I agree.
Want
to move this back, but... My point is, I do agree with you over these giant halls, which is like any civilization capable of building in a mountain something that impressive, you'd think it'd be able to build something better than the bow that they used to try and shoot down the dragon, right?
Right.
Like, you've clearly got the ability to manipulate really large quantities of material and do very complex structural engineering.
Yet they only made, like, 6 arrows.
Yeah, it's like seems slightly odd, but anyway, but that does end up with these massively huge statues, halls, and stuff that seem oddly hard to justify. Though I will say, there's one point about this that, and I've been saying this for a while because I thought all this through the other films as well. I did love at the Elvian Kingdom that you actually had a sense of there being a servant class that was, you know, looking after the royals and handling their alcohol requirements, and that's where the barrel room all came in.
Yeah.
Because I said the same thing, I think, about Thor, for example, that when you've just got the pomp and ceremony at the front and there's no sense of, well, where do these people go to sleep? Where do these people go to eat? Like, what's the system for, you know, it's the realism of everyday life that gives the infrastructure of a city that makes a city believable. So I think Lake Town looked believable. It looked like people went to the toilet, that they had to get supplies in, that there was issues to do with, you know, how they earned a living and how they did things that made it all sort of oddly believable that you would have a town on a lake and it was functioning. And I got a bit of that at the Elvian Kingdom. I just don't get that at some of these other locations. Never have.
I thought that whatever it was, Elf Town or whatever that was, like, I just thought it was weird. It was like, there's only, it seemed like even with the few servants that are, like, you know, I guess they were stuffing barrels or emptying barrels or whatever, that something with barrels, right, for the whole barrel sequence. But the I thought there was only like a dozen people in the whole place, right? I mean, like, there was never like very many people present in their whole, I don't know, maybe there's only a dozen elves or something. It was weird. It always felt so empty, this huge space where there, like, you did see a
That's
few people,
true.
But not like in the town on the lake where you did see there was actually a much larger population, like, and it felt like a more, you know, kind of lived in space.
But if we get back to the dragon for a second, because we've kind of drifted off that. I mean, if you accept that that is hard because you've got it in very large spaces, and because it's in very large spaces, it's even harder to note its size. I thought the framing and the blocking and the camera work really set stuff up well as you could in that environment of having that much gold. Like, I mean, for example, when it's revealed under the gold and you have it, its size, you know, shown a bit by it rustling on the right of shot and on the left of shot.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
Completely sort of, you know, that gave you a good tangible sense of scale. But the other thing is, they didn't tend to hide stuff through quick editing or, you know, flashes. I mean, you got to see a lot of stuff slowly evolving and slowly happening with Smaug, which I thought was terrific. And you know, I mean, I do stand by the fact that it's a very hard character to animate, you'd think, on paper, to get the lip sync to work, to get a facial expression out of it, to have it believable as a evil character, but also one that's inquisitive and can be flattered. And even though it claims it doesn't, you know, you can stop yourself being eaten by flattering me, it's exactly what, you know, he's doing and works really well. He engages him in conversation, which is, I think, one of the most delightful parts of the book as well.
I think it's also really hard to, you know, to show a character walking and using wings as hands with the little tiny T-Rex claws at the end and still have it be agile.
Yeah.
Because he was pretty agile.
There's some interesting facts about this as well. In the Hobbit film that preceded this, we saw a different Smaug. He had four legs and then wings on his back, kind of thing. And if you want to check that, don't go to the DVD, because they actually redesigned him for this film and then went back and changed the animation in the first film. So the one on the DVD matches this film. So there was a huge evolution between film one and film two on Smaug and on what he looked like and how he worked and actually his limbs and how those limbs worked, especially with the wings and the idea of having like four legs and then two wings attached above. But the other thing that I think is really significant about this character from a visual effects point of view is the muscle system. Now, I don't remember, we were talking around the time of Life of Pi, but a point that was raised to us when we were doing the research on Life of Pi is that one of the problems with muscle systems in characters is that they tend to work in reverse of real life. In other words, you tend to move a limb, which causes the muscles to bulge or contract. And of course, a predator tends to tense muscles before they spring and leap. And so the muscles should precede the action because it's the muscles that cause the action, not the action causing the muscles. But because of the nature of modern computer graphics, we've always approached it the other way around. Like you move the arm and then it changes the muscles to kind of vary stuff. And so in this film, they not only did some really amazing stuff there, but the muscle system itself is really advanced. So instead of being muscles, like for Joe Lettieri talked about this at a VES talk, but muscles used to be, this character has muscles, he's got a muscle system, but as he described it himself, that used to be really a kind of fallacy. What they really had was inflatable bladders that were in the place of a muscle. So a bicep is effectively an inflatable bladder on a computer graphics level. So if I move my arm of my character, then it causes the bladder to inflate or deflate based on this idea of it coming after the event as the computer graphics sort of reverse engineers it in. In this one, they actually have, and have developed at Weta, proper muscle fibers that actually let them pre-fire the muscle bundles before the action happens. So in addition to that giving us really great motion and the ability to actually have a predator attack in the way that a predator would, with that kind of springing and pre-tensing, it also means that everything else down the line that feeds off that is more accurate. The skinning, the subsurface scattering is more accurate because it's over a more accurate layer of muscles. I mean, I think the level of technical excellence in this character from Weta is just breathtaking. I mean, it's really, really first class. Now, I've done a lot of talking. Matt, do you want to comment?
With regards to the dragon? I mean,
yeah, and this muscle system and articulation of the character.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of those things, like, I thought, I didn't notice as much any of the muscle systems per se. I think what I really noticed more was, because it was sort of more the central focus, was really the facial animation. But then also there was a lot of sort of secondary movement that took place in the long neck of mm-hmm. the character. And I saw a lot of that kind of movement in that, you know, the head would twist maybe, you know, on its axis, right? The head would twist like you were tilting your head, right? Like a dog would tilt its head. The head would twist kind of in that direction, right? But then further down the neck, you would see this kind of movement that would happen, this sort of secondary movement of the flesh that was sort of not quite as rigid, and it would happen sort of in a graduated fashion down towards the torso. And I thought that kind of secondary movement was really interesting. And then I think, like, you know, I think it was Jason maybe was saying, right, with regards to the way in which the wings folded up, and that kind of, that's a weird anatomical form that's sort of hard to wrap your head around, that kind of almost like a, you know, like an old pterodactyl or something. Like,
well, I think there are some bats that have an action that's not dissimilar to that, I think. Yeah. And I think that was referenced by the guys that were doing Game of Thrones, that at the walking level.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And I think but that's such an interesting thing to see. It's not something, at least, you know.
Very unusual. Yeah.
I don't see it that frequently. And so, like, when you see it, especially on that something that's that scale, I think visually it's interesting to look at, you know. And I think it raises a lot of, like, wait, it looks, you know, I guess it looks right, but it's sort of hard to know. Like you were saying, like, you know, well, what does look right? Like, it's a dragon, you know, you don't really know for sure, but I think it's, it felt, believable as a creature in that regard.
Yeah.
Can we also talk about the coins and the gravity?
Yeah. Yeah. No, go right ahead. I mean, it was a hell of a lot of coins, by the way. We, have an interview on FX Guide with the team, and it's worth listening to that because, well, I won't give you the answer, but let me just set it up by saying, Jason, that Forbes magazine estimated that Smog was the richest character in literature, and I think they estimated his value, like his actual wealth, at, I'm going to say, $62 billion, and they're way out. So if you want to find out how much Morgan is actually worth in New Zealand dollars, check out our podcast over at FX Guide. Somebody at Weta actually worked out the volume area of gold and then did it on current day gold prices in New Zealand. And we can exclusively publish his net value over at FX Guide. I'm sorry, I've checked it out. Yes, it was Michael Knoll at Forbes magazine who valued him $62 billion. Completely wrong. I'm sorry, FX Guide running financial rings around Forbes magazine in this particular aspect.
Well,
but
maybe
he is, I will say, the wealthiest fictional character in all of literature and television, I'd say.
Maybe Smog could buy Apple.
I think he actually could. If you listen to our podcast, I think you'll have no doubt that he could.
Maybe he should.
but I digress. So let's discuss the coins. A heck of a lot of sim work went into them. I think there was one sim that had a billion coins involved. What do you think of them?
I mean, I had seen some BTS stuff, and I was actually quite astonished at how much real production design there was on the set pieces that they used of coins and varying bowls and plates and weird other shaped things that Smog had in there. But I mean,
do you want the good news or that or the bad news?
Both.
They were made of polystyrene, not gold, and as a consequence, they didn't tend to move correctly, so most of them were replaced in post.
Well, so they still thought about it. There was still quite a lot.
And they did a lot for Bilbo to run down, yes.
Yeah. True. But like when Smog would move his tail and you'd see this cascade of coins or anything that was under him, or even when they stepped or moved, I mean, it was just impeccably believable. There was no, I don't think there was any CG or sim where it came to the coins and the treasure area that I ever felt like there was a cheat or there was something not right. Like it felt completely under their feet and moving appropriately, both from a gravity and like a slide, cascading avalanche type motion. I thought it was incredible, incredibly well done.
Do you snowboard or ski?
I snowboard.
So did you feel, as I did, that some of it had that, so you'll see it on a decent slope that like a border will go through and you'll kick up kind of a powdery, that stuff that's gone from powder to the edge of just clumping, and it falls with that kind of, it falls over itself kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems so familiar the way those coins were falling from what I've seen with snow over the years. It just I totally agree with you. It looked really, really realistic.
Yeah, and that's sort of, I had seen Frozen a couple weeks before. And I had the same feeling, because I know Disney did so much work on the snow sims, that, you know, if you really got into a serious argument about it, I would swear that they shot a real moose in snow and then comped in their, you know, CG moose, because it just, the way the snow fell over itself and bunched and moved and squeaked and whatever was just insane. And I... As soon as I saw the coins, I've had the same feeling.
Yeah, no, it's a shame we don't have a Frozen show to do, but I do think Frozen is a incredible film, and it's actually really, really interesting how solid the Disney side of the Disney Pixar teams are at the moment, because that's the same team that did Tangled and a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah.
And now there's still some duds in there. I think the planes thing is like a nightmare of a film, but yeah, it's great to see that Disney's putting out some really, really good stuff. And I do agree that their snow sim, which they actually showed at SidGraph Asia, I think, is the clumping and the way that stuff is running is spectacular. The coins are ridiculously large in number, but that doesn't defeat the fact that they are remarkable in their sort of I guess fluidity is the word, but that just the way they kind of rolled down, because there was a large section when he's starting to get down the hill where you had that kind of rolling stuff going on, that it is, I just, again, I haven't seen it anywhere else done this well. I thought that the gold coins were terrific, and also I did like the lighting effect that gave to Smog, this sort of big broad uplight always makes somebody look evil, so it just all kind of worked well in the under the mountain stuff. I thought it was great.
I guess with that whole sequence, I guess when I was sort of saying that I thought it was so the grade was so desaturated, except when, you know, his chest, and I did like that effect, that how his chest, the underglow of sort of the fire and the sort of the furnace, and as it, you know, would start to then come out. I thought that was really cool. And I thought the fire was really great. The dragon fire. But I don't know why, and maybe this is like, you know, it harkens back to like my weird childhood memory of the Rankin-Bass cartoon of The Hobbit, you know? And I don't know, there's something about that opportunity where, you know, there was this gold in this huge space, and then this, you know, really incredibly complex creature, and to take so much of the color out of it in the grade, I just thought, I don't know, I felt like it was a really missed opportunity for some really interesting, additional interesting visual opportunities from a filmmaking point of view. And I don't know, it felt like it had a really heavy hand.
Well, like what? I mean, where would additional light be coming from?
Well, I mean, I think you could have had, I mean, even after he would breathe fire, like nothing ever caught fire, right? So there was never any firelight other than when it would sort of breathe, he'd breathe it out and then it would dissipate and then it was gone. And so
right.
It just felt like as a sequence, I guess that started to happen more when then the furnaces started, right? And then you started to get a little bit additional, kind of like an orange or yellowish kind of firelight coming into the environment. But I don't know, that whole long dialogue sequence, which I did think was probably the better part of, at least for me, of the character development part of it, you know, where it felt like there was some intrigue going on as to what was he going to do. I don't know, I just, it felt like to me watching, I was just like, wow, like, you know, is there something, I kept thinking, is there something wrong with the projector in here? Like, it's so, I mean, it really felt to me like it was just almost like grayscale. Like, there was so little color. I don't know. I just thought it seemed really heavy to me. I don't know.
Well, I mean, Peter Jackson's palette in general is that it's poppy, but it's muted at the same time, which sounds kind of weird to say. But, and all there's like a promist on everything. You know what I mean? Like, if you know what a promist filter looks like as a camera person, all the blacks are bloomed. It feels like, you know what I mean? Like, at least in a lot of the situations, he has a very, I guess you would call it cartoony to a certain extent, a very cartoony style to his color and his look, I think.
I guess I just thought that sequence was the antithesis of that. Like, it had none of that. Like what you're describing to me, it was so, there was nothing cartoony about it in terms of the color. I mean, it was almost right. Colorless.
Yeah.
I mean, I like that we had sequences that were in full sun with the bright highlights of the water, and that we had this contrast with the dark. I mean, I don't know if you're saying things should have caught a light, but obviously in a stone building with metal coins, not a lot is
what would catch on fire. There's nothing stopping in a movie like this from, if you wanted to, in terms of the art direction, to say like, well, I want to have, you know, there's some torches or something around, or some, you know, I mean, it could be anything. There could be any other kind of light source.
Yeah. I mean, you know, he's been asleep for a couple hundred years. I'm good with that kind of being gloomy. And also, I think it let them go somewhere with the next sequence in the furnaces, where they obviously did have a lot more. And once you started pouring the gold really sat out there because it was glowing. So it was its own illuminated system. I mean, I think the gold was hard to get great because I don't think we know what gold looks like when it's molten that well as people. I mean, it's not something I can really relate to. So it ends up looking like a bit like lobby water because it has a much higher viscosity. And I that's why I sort of think that maybe, and also that whole idea of like putting it into the mold of the statue and then that only being sort of cooled at the outside but not enough to keep the interior molten.
Oh, yeah, that was sort of weird. I didn't quite grasp what happened there. Like, they set that up so quick and it was like, wow, you know, like, it's convenient that that huge thing was there, and then it melted like it was like a big butter sculpture or something. Like,
well, I think the interior was molten while the exterior was but you know, there was when you've had that with molten lava, you get that crust on it and a kind of patina that just gives it a very different look. And that crusting on lava really helps sell it. And of course, I don't think you get that kind of crusting on pure gold, and consequently, it tends to look slightly more metaballsy, kind of blobby than.
Right. It's a weird problem visually, for sure. Yeah.
And see, I don't think it's a technical problem either, because here's a film that had like 70 water sims in the, you know, 7-minute sequence. I mean, how many water sims they would have had, but like a lot of, you know, heavy duty water sims for that. And they clearly can do spectacularly good water. So it's just trying to get a substance on a scale also that I'm not used to, because if I've ever seen anything molten gold, it's been at ring level kind of scale, like a tiny little thing pouring into a tiny little mold. Sure. I've never seen...
There's that gold Apple iPhone commercial right now is the other thing that I keep thinking of when you're talking about molten gold. And they do a thing in that, which is, I mean, it's a much smaller scale again, but they do a thing in that where it is kind of a lava crusted kind of like it's like a piece of ore or something, and so there's a dark outer casing on it, which is, I mean, it's a neat piece of animation, but it's a totally different scale as well.
Yeah. What did you guys think of the water rapids, the barrel sequence, from a technical point of view? Because this had some really interesting aspects, not least of which is that in a film that's was primarily shot on stereo epics. It had some GoPro stereo footage in it.
I mean, I sort of alluded to it earlier a little bit. I mean, I feel like I'm being like a total dick. I'm not trying to sound like a total, like, you know, negative Nancy or anything about the whole thing, or a wet blanket. But you know, I felt like that barrel sequence, to me, it was reminiscent of the Brontosaurus chase in King Kong. It felt like that same sequence to me in a way, only it took place in a different environment. But they felt visually really similar, and I thought they suffered from some of the same problems. I thought, you know, we were just talking about the fluid sims. I actually thought the fluid sims in that the barrel sequence, I don't know, I wasn't buying it. I didn't think it looked that hot. Like, I thought a lot of the time the water, it didn't even look like water. I thought it looked like shaving cream, like half the time. It was so much white water that there was almost nothing through it at the bottom. Like it, there were a few sequences where like you kind of got a little bit further away and there was a little bit more perspective. And then you're like, oh, okay, there's a waterfall, like, you know, in the distance up there that you could see. But a lot of the time, at least in, again, you know, I don't know what it looked like in the non-high frame rate version, but in the HFR version that I saw, it was just all white. Like, it was this white kind of, almost, it looked like white thread sometimes. It looked like shaving cream. It didn't often, to me, look like water. And I don't know. I felt like it didn't work. And then I thought there were some really rough composites in that sequence too that didn't quite work. And I don't know, again, it's really hard for me to judge it. You know, I feel like it's one I'd have to go back and look at a few times in a few different formats, but I felt like, you know, the planar kind of quality of some of the 3D maybe was part of what was troubling to me in that, or if it was like there weren't enough like sort of secondary or even photographic elements inserted in some of the foreground parts, like where you were seeing close-ups of, you know, some of the characters in their barrels. And I don't know, I actually thought that sequence was you know, you could see the ride at Disneyland or whatever, right?
Yeah. it definitely went very long.
Yeah, I just,
it's,
I don't
about
know,
7 minutes long.
And a lot of, to me, just a lot of the technical aspects of the sequence, it didn't work as well for me. And then you had the two elf characters sort of running alongside with all the are those orcs?
Yep.
Is that what they are? And they're sort of running alongside, and they're constantly shooting arrows. And I don't know. It was a lot of stuff happening simultaneously. And then I don't know. I just the base part of the environment, the river and the rapids of the river, you know, I thought didn't work very well.
I had an issue with a number of composites too, where I don't know if they comped somebody in or it was a matter of the 3D also, but there were times where the characters were really close in the foreground and they'd duck under a log or something would come at the screen and it definitely looked comped in. You know, there would be like a weird water splash that wasn't fully white. It was, you know, kind of brownish and just like a shape, like almost like a gobo in the front. And there was a couple times like that I saw some weird, again, I'm not sure if it was just a stereo thing or...
Yeah, that's what I wasn't sure about either. But, you know, if I could, I mean, I feel like this is... and, you know, feel free, Mike, to step in and stop me if you think this is, like, going out of line or anything. But, and I don't mean it to be. I mean this respectfully. I know a lot of people that work at Weta, and I think they're great. You know, they do great work and stuff. But I look at a film like this, and I wonder sometimes, and I don't know, this is totally anecdotal, but I wonder sometimes, I think back to King Kong and the experience on King Kong where, you know, the movie was very long. The studio people came to check out a screening of the movie, and we were thinking, oh, they're going to cut a bunch of sequences. This will be great, you know. We'll be able to focus in on, you know, the sequences that really need some help right now. And they had the screening for the executives from the studio, and they were like, we love it, don't cut anything, right? And so they didn't cut anything. And the movie came in at, you know, whatever, 2 hours and 50 some odd minutes or something. And then everybody was like, oh, great, like now we're going to be working, you know, 100 hours a week to try to get this movie done in time. And I sometimes look at a movie like this and I wonder if... you know, if sometimes that kind of mindset, whether it's, you know, the studio or the filmmaker or, you know, maybe even people are like, yeah, let's do this, you know, and kind of gung-ho in the trenches too. But I look at things like this sometimes and I wonder if, you know, is it too much of an ask? You know, are you trying to do too much and create too much, you know, in too tight of a time frame where there's so many shots that really to make them all look good, like the shot count is so high, and you're still dealing with people who are incredibly talented. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I don't fault any individual artists for any of it, but I just think that maybe there's a point at which, you know, the schedule, the money, and the ambition, you know, do they click and can they fire on all cylinders? Or are there gonna be things that you have to sort of set aside and let go, you know, and say like, well, okay, it's good enough. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. See, I mean, I have such a central problem with the premise that, cause I think that it does work and I think they've done spectacularly well. I mean, we know from, as I say, Joe Letteri stuff at VES that they were on 7 days a week for about 2 or 3 months before the end. So they were definitely pushing it. In fact, I think he said that, that they delivered 700 shots in the last 3 weeks before the film was completed.
Is that a good thing, though? I mean, that seems so unhealthy.
No, that's me just saying that you're right, there was a lot of work. And things like the forge sequence with Smog came late, and so that added to the workload. I think there were, he said, 1,970 shots, of which there was, on top of which there was another 500 sort of in what you call simple wire removal sort of stuff. So that's a huge amount of work, but I would not say that I thought that the work suffered. I would say that they delivered an incredibly impressive film. See, I liked the visual effects in this film, and there are a couple of shots. Like when I saw this, I thought, "Oh, you guys are going to probably not enjoy a couple of shots," and I'm probably going to say, "Yeah, there are some shots I feel bad criticizing, but yeah, you know, there's some wide shots when you've got small creatures set into the landscape that feel still to this day to me a bit gamey. They seem to be either moving too fast relative to the ground. Not that they're not anchoring on their ground plane, but it's not the tracking is off. It's just that they literally, if they were running on the ground there, they wouldn't cover much actual distance. It wouldn't make for very interesting shots. So somehow they miraculously kind of cover more ground than they should, which always makes them look a bit fake. That was the discussion I was expecting us to have. I didn't expect you to be
I think that that's, but, you know, that's a, that I would just say that's totally fair, and like we can disagree in that respect, yeah, for sure. But I'm sure I'll get a lot of, you know, hate mail or whatever for
that's fair,
which is fine, we don't mind criticism
on the show as long as it's, yeah, no, look, honestly, we don't mind criticism on the show as long as it's not snarky and you've got some justification for it.
And I don't mean it in any way to be snarky. I just wonder you're dealing with 1,900 some odd shots and you've got, you know, people working 7 days a week to complete the shots in that movie. Yeah, you're going to get some great shots. But I think that, you know, the QC, when you've got I mean, I worked a couple 110-hour work weeks. And, like, I mean, you know, not, I don't say that with any pride. Like, I think that was the stupidest thing I've ever done. Like, I wish done that. And I look back on that and I just think that, you know, the quality control, not just of the people supervising the job, but, like, you can't physically and mentally work hours like that and deliver great work. And so, I don't know, I thought there were some shots in this movie that I didn't think worked, and I thought there were some shots in the movie that had some real problems. And the only point I'm trying to make, I guess, is I wonder, from my perspective, my thought goes to, you know, is it possible that some of these things are the result of, you know, being sort of over scheduled, I don't know, where it's like you're not getting enough, you know, quality, you know, REM sleep or something to be able to go back and effectively do good work.
But that, you know, that has the underlying assumption that the work isn't up to par.
Well, I'm not saying that that's an assumption. I'm saying that's my opinion, right? I'm not saying it's an underlying assumption. I'm saying it's my opinion. And if that's my opinion, I'm justifying my opinion to myself from my own perspective by thinking about the context in which, you know, the conditions are being described. And it makes me wonder if that's one of the reasons why I'm having that interpretation myself. And, you know, people can certainly disagree, and I respect that opinion too, but that's my point of view, I guess. Does that make sense?
I will. Yes. I'm going to move on.
Okay.
The water sequence for me had some other aspects about it that I thought were astonishing. And we've got some stats on that, that I don't think anyone else has. So let me just give you a couple of stats that I think are kind of mind-blowing. The water sequence was 7 minutes long. Anyone want to guess what the shooting ratio was? 7 minutes, quite a long time.
1 to 1.
probably 10 to 1.
Yeah. No, you might want to try guessing again. So this is how much footage of live action, CG, that ended up in editorial that then got cut into the 7 minutes. There's, you know, so obviously 10 to 1 would be not a dumb number that would happen in quite often in a film. People ship 10 to 1 shooting ratio. 21, not uncommon. In fact, 100 to 1 in a documentary is not unheard of. So it might surprise you to know that when all was said and done, there was 98 hours of footage that was edited down to the 7 minutes. So by my reckoning, doing some math, it was an 843-to-1 shooting ratio.
Jesus.
Yeah.
That's crazy. That's nuts.
I mean, watching the behind the scenes on it, I saw for that scene alone, they had a stage inside built with green screen and rocks and the whole shebang and the elves running around and shooting, you know, invisible arrows, and the guys in the barrels and with running water, and the guys, the cameramen with their floating robot boxes with the cameras, stereo rigs in them.
Yep.
And then they show another section where they're shooting outside in a river with the exact same shit happening. I can only imagine that they did that about 1,000 times.
Yeah, the reason the shooting ratio gets so high is that you have lots of cameras rolling on action that you can't control. So you have multiple takes in multiple action. With my shooting ratio didn't allow for that stereo factor. But it was, you know, that you have, yeah, like a lot of coverage because you've got, you know, you start someone down a river with a GoPro, it's going to film the entire time it takes until someone can get it at the other end and switch it off, right? It's like, so you're going to have high shooting ratio.
Do you think they'll put a bunch of that back in the extended edition?
No, I don't. But I do think that the editorial team deserves kudos because it's a big job to edit an action sequence like that. And this wasn't just a case of, getting some really funky angles out of CG. They did have a huge amount of CG and a huge amount of digital water and stuff, but they had, for example, 35 hours of dry set green screen footage that they shot of people in barrels and motion capture in barrels and other stuff that then, you know, went into an edit that got cut down for the shots that were actually rendered out of the Weta team. So it was just the editing team on this film. The editing team on this film did a really good job. The other couple of crafts I reckon deserved a nod. I think the costumes on this were once again spectacularly good. I mean, I really just think that fitting out and doing, well, costumes, I'm going to include in that all the swords and propping that they're carrying with them kind of stuff. It's just spectacular. I mean, production design on these films is just an art form beyond belief. And the quality of those props, it never looked like they were kind of cardboard. It never looked like they were kind of dodgy. You know, I think it was just really, really...
I would say also probably based on the shooting ratio subject we just went over, also the script supervisor would be quite... Deserved,
I would like to see the script
quite
for
a
the
number of kudos.
Yeah, but the they did previous the Whitewater scene. There was
what was the shooting was ratio also, on the previs?
They did 1,091 previs shots that that went into a cut to work out what the final cut was. Now I don't know how many shots there were in. I think I worked out though that there were 257 cuts in the entire film Gravity. So that gives you a benchmark. But yeah, I mean, Moulin Rouge hit about 3,000 cuts in the whole film, 3,500, and that was considered one of the cuttiest films of all time.
Well, I made a 25-minute film that had 500 cuts in it, so I can sympathize.
Yeah, so... yeah, so... action sequences do plow through cuts. Anyway, I just wanted to give some shout-out to the editorial team because I think it's an amazing kind of feat to pull that kind of footage down together. And there's also a time constraint thing, right? Like, I mean, a documentary or something, you'd have a year or two to edit that to try to find the best shots and find the best angles and put it all together. Coping with that much footage is spectacularly difficult.
And shooting epic at 5K, probably 4:1. Or 5:1 compression. So those are they're generating, it's just insane amounts of data by the minute, much less by the day.
Yeah, I know it's a astonishing amount of stuff. I mean, I have a lot of time for a lot of the departments on this film. It comes as no shock because I really like the film this much. But you know, yeah, I thought that. That there was a lot of stuff in this that was just so good. Editing is just one of them. I mean, Jason, I'd be interested in your opinion on the cinematography, for example.
I did like the cinematography. I mean, I think the I liked the forest scene, which we haven't even talked about with the spiders, where when Bilbo goes up to the canopy and looks out over the canopy and gets some real nice actual sunlight, you know, feel to the shot with all those colored butterflies and birds and whatnot. I thought that was a really nice shot. I thought overall the cinematography was good. I'm trying to think if there's anything that stuck out as like I didn't, you know, as a shot that seemed weird. I mean, I think the cinematography overall was good. I think it was.
I mean,
some really
Andrew
nice.
Andrew Leslie is a DOP.
Yeah,
I mean, he and Roger Deakins. There's a few of them that I just would like, you know, see anything they shot really because they're so good at what they do. And again, it's like a really big film to mount, like
for sure.
Just the, you know, to generate that much footage, you have to have a lot of cameras and a lot of teams and a lot of people doing coverage and shooting, you know, tremendously complicated stuff. And just keeping your head across it is a hard job.
Yeah, and I think it was I mean, at that level, you know, with like Prometheus and the Hobbit movies, the epic is so clean, especially in low light. Not to make this a Red-specific comment, but they did shoot on the epics. It's amazing that it looks so good. I mean, I know it's a good camera. I like it. I have with some, but to see it on the big screen at that level, I really didn't see any real issues, you know, from a camera perspective that jumped out at me.
Yeah, I think from my point of view, a lot of the films in The Lord of the Rings do go dark. And so some of that night stuff, I guess it's much more difficult in a fully digital environment to sort of draw the line between Andrew Leslie's work stops and starts. But there were other scenes that were beautifully lit that were clearly like a lot less done from a fully CG point of view. I mean, it's hard to know where any of these lines were drawn, but yeah, I think his cinematography and style is good. I think also I criticized heavily in the first film the fact that there were a lot of windows that were put underneath Gandalf's hat so as to allow him to have a lit up face. And so I deliberately looked at that again, and I found that to be a considerably better situation this time around. In other words, we would see his face. There was clearly some kind of artificial lighting that was causing us to be able to see his face, whether it be a power window or whether it be bounce light or whatever you like. But that being said, it was a lot more sellable. It was a lot more believable. Right. It was a lot more in keeping with the kind of, just in the first film, I felt like somebody put a bloody great round oval power window there and just wound the crap out of it. And I just found it very off-putting that he would be that lit up under a hat. This time it was more motivated, I thought. So there was a couple of shots still that was a little bit, and it's a huge problem with having a character that has such a big hat. Though he seemed to lose it. I don't know if he's going to have it in the third film, but he seemed to lose his hat in this one in the middle of running around discovering armies about to march of orcs.
Matt, I was curious what you thought about the necromancer and his sort of black wind, blurry wind, and then his transformation into Sauron.
Oh, I mean, I think that it was kind of cool. It was real. It was like a the smoke part when he was just the smoke. You know, in all honesty, it didn't really do a lot for me. It felt so formless. But I guess when it turned into the flaming eye, I mean, and then it kind of like it did this weird thing editorially that was kind of cool, where it pulsed a couple times, where you kind of like it was like full screen and you kind of went through it like a couple times.
Yeah,
and it felt like it was
the
almost
2001
like a
sequence.
Yeah, it was kind of like this psychedelic kind of moment. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. But yeah, I don't know. That wasn't one of the I think of all the of all the effects in the whole movie, I mean, it really, I think it was the dragon more than anything for me that really stood out as something that felt, really powerful as like as an effect.
Yeah, I'm just saying, as a directorial creative choice to go literally, you could say the complete opposite of Smaug. For the necromancer to be almost nothing.
I mean, I'll be totally honest with you. Like, I didn't read these books as a kid. Like, I saw the cartoon, I think, when it was on TV. Like, I was never really a huge. Yeah, I saw the Bakshi one. Ralph Bakshi? Yeah, the Lord of the Rings one that he did. And then the Hobbit, the Rankin Bass Hobbit cartoon. And I think they did a Return of the King one, too, at one point. Which was really goofy, but I didn't read these books or anything as a kid, so I found the script and the plot, you know, difficult to follow. Like, they immediately jump in and they're having this whole dialogue about all these things and these characters and things that, like, you know, if you haven't read the book, you know, and you're not an ardent fan of the series, like, I think there's not a very easy entry point into the narrative. I mean, you know, you can just follow the narrative, you know, visually and be like, oh, they're going here and they're going there. And I guess that works, you know. But I mean, I didn't know that was a character. I was just like, well, what is that black smoke thing? I guess that's like some bad dude, like evil force, you know, but like,
yeah.
So what? Like, it comes and goes, and it didn't really seem to be doing much.
Matt, let me just limit you. There were a lot of in-jokes for people that were getting in-jokes. You noticed one of the, as you called it, I think you described the dwarfs as the short people, but had a thing in his wallet with his wife and his child.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That?
In the yeah, and they said that, and the one the guy elf. Was like, oh, is that your... Is that your son?
You realize that that character then is in Lord of the Rings. The son in the book, in the wallet, is then the character in. There's like tons of that stuff all the way through.
Well, and he's in.
He's the Lord of the Rings movies.
And he's the character that Legolas, who's saying that, it becomes his best friend.
Best friend, yeah. So there's loads of stuff there for fans. Let's face it, at the screening that I was at, there were actually people dressed as elves and hobbits and dwarfs.
I have to say, I was a big fan of the books as a kid, and
yeah, I mean, a lot of people were. I mean, that's cool.
When he said, I didn't remember The Hobbit as much, and when he said that was Gimli, there were people in the theater that were like, whoa, you know, like it definitely resonated with people. But, you know, after I saw the first movie in the theater, I started reading the book to my kid, The Hobbit, and we literally read the exact number of pages that the first movie covers, and the book is equally as boring and plodding for that section as well.
I was reading it,
and I'm like, this is like a 50-page dinner sequence, and I'm like, oh, right, and it's like 40 minutes in the movie.
I can't help but think that watching, like, I've seen the first two movies, right, and I just can't help but think, like, why not just make it into one movie? Like, I could think of a million things that you could cut out of this story and the previous one. Like,
okay,
probably make well,
I'd say several
film,
billion
you know?
Dollars would be the reason.
Well,
to cut them into
I can tell you my theory.
About, you know?
My theory on why they made multiple films outside of just money from a studio perspective is that both the cast and Peter Jackson got royally screwed on profit sharing for the first three films, which were arguably the largest grossing trilogy on the planet, especially based on their cost, right? And which is why initially Peter Jackson didn't want to make The Hobbit at all, because he was basically like, fuck you to the studios, you're not going to screw me over again. And
he was very supportive of a version being done under his kind of
but he wasn't going to direct it. He was like, I'll EP it to make sure that it stays true to my vision, but I'm not directing it. And it went through Guillermo del Toro, who eventually had to, you know, go make his own movies because it was taking so long. And I don't think it wasn't initially going to be three movies. It was going to be only two. And I think it literally was Peter Jackson bending the studios over a barrel and saying, okay, you want me to do this? You're going to pay me. I mean, this is my own theory.
Hang on, I don't even
a
know
a lot
that it's,
of money to
but,
do
but
this.
Hang on. I know it's fun to just have pot shots at the studios, but I mean, like everybody, I mean, let's not deny it, right? Everybody stands to make a fortune
absolutely
out of three films instead of two, in the same way that in The Hunger Games, they're going to go for four films instead of three. And in the same way in Harry Potter, they went for eight instead of seven.
However, New Line Cinemas, after the first three movies, claimed they never made a profit. So
well,
I'm just saying, Hollywood accounting.
I mean,
of course,
so many
that's
films
Hollywood accounting. I'm not saying New Line specifically is the only studio that does this. I'm just saying that studios,
which is
have
why
a,
when you get
have
someone,
a way of,
but yeah,
of
I know, but that's why if you look at the stuff that, for example, you got Tom Cruise's contracts, he's getting points off the top gross before any subtractions.
Of
right?
course,
and
but not many
just,
people can do that.
Well, no, true. But my point is that, like, you know,
and he's doing that because he knows he's going to get royally screwed out of any money.
He's
going to
get royally screwed. He makes quite a lot of money out of films, actually. I mean, I did an entire class on this in Background Fundamentals. I mean, and I would also say that Tom Cruise earned that money, because without Tom Cruise's involvement,
absolutely,
some of those films would never have been made. Whether you like Tom Cruise or not, he's an enabler of films getting greenlit.
No,
I
agree
just think,
with you.
I just think that I don't know that it's fair to paint Peter Jackson as screwing the studio.
Well, I don't think he's screwing the studio. I think he's doing what he can to make sure that his ass is covered this time. This is pure speculation on my point, but I would imagine that he would want to make sure that he was getting
covered
up front.
Can I just say, your cynical view of the film industry has me in stitches at times. I'm pretty sure it was you that posted that Twitter post during the week about Cameron doing Avatar 2, 3. It had me doubled over.
Well, that was a story thing, not a money thing. I'm happy that people are going to be employed for 110 hour work weeks for the next, you know, 4 years, but it's more just I didn't like the first movie that much, and I personally don't want to see three more of them. But I, you know, kudos to him to be able to make them. He's James Cameron. You know, he earned the right to do whatever he wants.
Yes. If you're wondering what I'm referring to, during the week, they announced that Avatar was going to be done in New Zealand, and that there's a large amount of government funding going on. And lots of people were putting out very witty tweets about this. And they were very funny. But I think you put out one that basically sort of said, hang on a second, forget about the money. Did anybody else think it's really odd that we need three more Avatar films? Yeah. I don't even agree with, but I thought it was funny.
You know, just on that note, like, and, you know, I'll try to keep this really brief, but, like, there were probably, I don't know, half a dozen or more trailers for other movies before the start of this film, right, at the theater I saw it at. My favorite of which, by the way, though, was the Gareth Edwards trailer for the new one for the Godzilla movie.
Yeah.
It's just fun to see that, you know, he's out there and he's making this huge movie. I'm just keeping my fingers crossed that, you know, it all comes together in a way that he's happy with. But and that was fun to see.
But there were
so many trailers for movies, and this is just my weird opinion, but there's movies like, there's the 47 Ronin where it looks like Keanu Reeves gets in a fight with a bunch of fabric or something, and then there's like, you know, some other movie with like Kate Winslet, and like it's like a Hunger Games type movie. I can't even remember what it was called. And I don't know, like, and then we're going to have, you know, three more Avatar movies, and we're going to have the third Hobbit movie and stuff. And I don't know, I do feel like, just myself, I feel like there's a level of fatigue, you know, like with all of these sort of franchise movies that are all so similar, and they're all going for this like big, giant, like bombastic, grandiose thing. And I wonder, you know, like, is that going to be, like, I walked out of this movie after seeing this movie, which I really didn't enjoy very much, as I made clear earlier, but then also having seen all those trailers, and I just felt so cynical about movies, and it was like, I felt dirty after all that. I don't know. And so just what you were saying with regards to, do we really need three more Avatar movies? Like, I mean, look, I love seeing my friends be able to go on to the next job and like stay gainfully employed. Like, I'm all for that. But at the same time too, like, I question at a certain point, and it's not up to me to question, it's just, but that's my opinion. I question the value of some of these big, giant projects when I think there's so many other really potent and powerful and meaningful and potentially hugely successful stories that could be told from people and voices and parts of the world that we don't get to hear from very much. And I wish that there were as much of a engaged investment on the creative side in pursuing some of those things, like, because I sometimes wonder if some of what we're getting is really, well, I don't know, just that's a
well before
judgment, but of value.
Before,
you know?
To that point, to your scale point, before we started doing this show, I was on my couch watching THX 1138. That was on, happened to be on cable, weirdly, and that is the antithesis of these giant movies. I mean, it's quite a small movie, but through the writing and really clever filmmaking, George Lucas is able to build this incredibly huge world of things going on and concepts and things with like a line of dialogue that you're like, what? Tells me a lot. And granted, he did a director's cut, you know, maybe it was like nine years ago, where he was able to add in, you know, CG stuff to just flesh out his story, but it wasn't necessary. It just made it a little cooler. I think there's a huge space for movies like that, you know, like Moon and like Monsters, and for movies that can really take advantage of visual effects from a story perspective instead of a spectacle perspective.
I'm not there on the cynicism right now. I mean, I'm looking at my slate of movies coming up, and this is the time of year in Australia where we get kind of more indie films happening. And so I already have tickets for Railway Man, which I'd recommend. I think it's going to be really, really interesting. These are films I haven't seen, so
what's
I'm just
that?
Recommending. Well, it's just exactly the sort of thing that you were describing, a small independent film about a guy going back to meet someone that was his captor, or I guess jailer, on the Changi Railway during the Second World War. It's The Book Thief. We've got a story on that on FX Guide at the moment, which I think is a really interesting story of a girl in Germany during the Nazi period and hiding a fellow who was Jewish. There's a great role of... Well, it's not his film, but Woody Allen's in a film called Fading Gigolo that looks hysterical, that I bought some early tickets to. It looks like a whole lot of fun. Just silly, and of one that I do know about, which is Wolf of Wall Street, which is Scorsese just bringing the house down. So, I'm you know, this idea that there's only big blockbuster Hollywood disaster-ish films or comic book films, I'm just not buying it. I mean,
well, I'm not I was just talking about visual effects. No, I was just related to visual effects.
There's a ton of visual effects in Wolf of Wall Street. Great film.
Yes.
Go see it.
I will.
And in The Book Thief, it's a small little film, but it's got, you know, great visual effects by Rise FX. I mean, I just I want to be glass half full. I mean, I'm filled with optimism for the state of storytelling and visual effects, because visual effects can go to films like The Book Thief and to films that aren't, you know, mega budgets. And
I guess just this movie in particular, like, it was so sour to me. Like, it left me feeling
I got that.
So I mean, I think that's
where, I liked it.
Yeah, but I think that's where it's coming from for me. It's coming from, you know,
Look, you know, I should say, listeners, that I completely respect Matt's point of view. Matt is an incredibly experienced, well informed, well read, somebody I respect his opinion of enormously in every respect other than this film. And
Batman trilogy.
We have him on. But, you know, no, you've clearly got a couple of screws loose. But apart from that, it's not like, but you're not on the show to deliberately be antagonistic.
No,
you're not on the show
no
to
way.
Deliberately cause problems. So I totally respect your point of view and disagree with
that. And I should say too, you know, I think I've said a couple times, like, you know, this isn't intended as an attack on anyone in particular, other than maybe Peter Jackson, but that's just my own belief. I just think that, you know, I try to be really frank and really honest about my perspectives and my opinions about whether it's the technical side of, you know, the visual effects and whether I think something works or doesn't work. But I also try to be really honest about whether or not I think the overall movie works. And, you know, I recognize that my particular taste may not be those of the larger box office. But that would be the case with any one of us at any given point in time, too. So,
yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I found Thor 1 to be
appreciate
absurd.
The... the word of support for my
So the reason I say that is because I know that somebody there's been two interesting opinions that I've had in relationship to the show. Not I've had a lot of opinions, but two that stuck out. One was that simultaneously we always agreed with each other, which made it not very interesting, and the other one was we deliberately didn't agree with each other just to make it more interesting. And I was like, neither is true. But there you go. Okay, so I think this film is terrific as a film. Totally recommend it. And not only that, I think that it should be one of the films nominated in the category of visual effects for this year. I think that Gravity is definitely a nominee, and I'm sure most people would say that it's got the front runner position for the Oscar. But I would say, in my opinion, there's no doubt that this film should be nominated. And not only that, but I'm going to say that the character animation, this because it wasn't really character animation in Gravity, is going to win the VES category for character animation for, you know, specific shot type stuff. So even if it doesn't win overall at the Oscars, it's going to be recognized in the VES awards for just the sheer excellence of character animation. So the only thing I can say to you, if you haven't seen the film, you shouldn't be listening to the podcast in the first place, but if you haven't seen the film, you should go out and see it. And then, hey, let us know what you think on Twitter. The VFX show has its own Twitter feed, which is obviously VFX show. Post. We'd love to hear your point of view. As I say, I couldn't disagree more with my esteemed colleague, Matt, but that's... It's a big internet. You can have opinions. It's fine. And it's great. And you know what? Coming up next year, we're going to have a ton of really interesting stuff coming out because some of these films we've discussed are going to be there. Can I just make one other shout out? I mentioned that we had some stuff on FX Guide about The Hobbit, which we do. There's also a special RC Christmas present with Rob Legato talking about Wolf of Wall Street. We had a really good reaction to this. It's only been out for a couple of days. But if you're interested in the side of filmmaking of visual effects that encompasses the cinematography and the how to light a green screen and how to go about getting shots to work and what it takes to sell a shot and just the process that someone would take that has Rob's unique perspective. Two-time Oscar winner. He's the second unit director, the second unit DOP, and the visual effects supervisor on Wolf of Wall Street, which has had really good response. One of Scorsese's best films. So if you want to check that out, that's a podcast over at FX Guide. And then also, we were talking about editing earlier, and I was going on about how impressed I was with the team at it's not Weta, but it's the production company.
Park Road.
I think it's Park Road. Well, actually, I think it's 3'7", but anyway, it's quite complicated. But there's another thing for FX Insider members on FX Guide, which is I sat down with Alan Bell, who was the editor on Catching Fire. Now, Alan did a couple of interviews, but I sat down with him and did something very different. I sat down with him and discussed two individual scenes, one which is the District 11 speeches where Katniss causes somewhat of a riot, and the second is the training room sequence. And the reason we did this is just to look at the editor's process. Like, you know, given a bunch of footage, how do you come about the cut? Who's in the room with you? How quickly do you show it to someone? Do you start on the wide and go for the close-ups? Do you go for the close-ups and then worry about the wides? I mean, how do you solve stuff when there is previews and when there isn't previews? And so that's another special bonus Christmas podcast over at FX Guide for those of you that are FX Guide members. If you're not a member of FX Guide Insider, I would totally recommend you give it to yourself as a Christmas present because it lets you get exclusive content, and it's also our way of, we provide bonus material to say thank you to you guys for supporting us, but the Insider program supports both this podcast and the rest of the work we do at FX Guide. So, and finally, in the way of plugs, if I can, and I'm on a roll here, I know, but if you are interested in FX PhD and you haven't found a Christmas present for people, we do have always available at Christmas time gift certificates you can give for training at our FX site, FX PhD, and those gift certificates are available for either a single course or a full term, and they're actually got a discount, a special Christmas discount. So if you buy them for somebody, you'll get them at a reduced price. So there you go. They're my ads for the day. And nothing left to do other than to thank you guys and ask where people can follow you. So starting with you, Matt, having gone blow to blow with me today.
Yeah, you can find me as always at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia, in the School of the Arts. Or you can find me on my website, which is mattwallen.com.
And Jason, who works very closely with his brother as a very talented team, where can we find you?
Matt, I thought you were going to say you could be found in the box above the stage in the Muppet Show, as either Statler or Waldorf. Yeah,
that would be a fun job.
You can find me at thediamondbros.com and on the Twitters as Jason Diamond. And in reference to your editor's comment about Alan Bell, there's a Twitter feed called Star Wipe My Ass that I like, that does a lot of production kind of stuff. And their tweet today was, "Remember, your clients cannot unsee rough cuts."
So. Yes, that's actually something I discussed with him as to showing temp grades and temp music, that very issue. Does he like to use temp music and does he do temp grades? Because people can fall in love with those things. No, look, yep. I totally agree. And in fact, I'd be welcoming any comments from Insider members on those Insider pieces at FX Guide, because if you guys like them, we might do more of these interviews with editors discussing the editing process and the decisions they make, whether to stay with the character from their character's point of view, and we as the audience only know what that character knows, which is something that Alan and I got into, or whether it be, you know, how they approach, you know, recutting a scene to make it very different from the one that it was. And I think it was Alan's talks, I'm pretty sure it made the cut when we did the edit, about Spider-Man. There was an actual scene that was one scene, and he just decided to recut it as two completely separate scenes, and they added it in some extra footage and turned what was one scene into two. And those are really fascinating discussions. If you want more of that kind of stuff, let us know, and we'll actually delve deeper into the editorial side of things. But that's it for this year. That's it for me. I'm out of here. Matt, thank you so much for the whole year's worth of contribution to the show.
Always a pleasure. It's so much fun. I totally enjoy it.
And Jason, I want to thank you. Not only have you contributed greatly to FX Guide, but also to PhD. Was it this year that we were together at Blowing Stuff Up? Was that this year? Was it?
I think it was a year ago, September.
There you go. So, so it's been, you've been a great contributor, and we really do appreciate it. I also want to thank the team, Todd Chilton, who's our producer. Todd works really hard behind the scenes putting together stuff for us, and we really do appreciate it. David does the editing for us out of Chicago. It's produced here by Ian in the Sydney office, who's always pulling his hair out trying to coordinate us to the same schedules, which is no one's problem. And of course, Jeff and John, the co-founders of FX Guide. But most importantly, I want to thank you guys for supporting us here. It's been a really great response. We do really, I always say this, but we really do like getting feedback, good or bad, and we take it on board and try and listen to it. And I know some of you know that we've done that because we've had direct conversations about it lately. So thanks, guys. See you in the new year. Please travel safe over the Christmas period, and we'll see you around Oscar time in 2014. Until then, I'm Mike Singel. See you.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.